right point after discussing the list. So I am, let me see that, I am recording now. Okay, so we are recording. The last time I wasn't able to extract the recording, my HD filled up. Simply, so I wasn't able to recover. So the recording of Greedy Albums 1 indeed is lost. So I made space on my hard disk, and hopefully now we will have the recording for this and the future lectures. When the amount of video material and stuff is kind of unexpectedly filling my hard disk. So hope that gets better. Good morning. Okay, thank you. Do you have a LaTeX template to deliver the list, or could it be free form? Yeah, it could be free form, but I possibly can, or maybe have a template. I can put a lecture notes, homepage, evaluation. No, there's nothing. So okay, yeah, that's not a problem, Marcio. I can put up an easy template. Just to make a, so yeah, just have to fill in the answers and can focus on the contents. You should not, I mean, LaTeX is one possibility, that's nice, and the stuff comes out really nice, but you should not have to struggle too much with LaTeX. So yes, I can put up a template. Okay, so other questions at the moment? Okay, so being at the page, looking ahead, so Greedy Algorithms 2, we have set that subset systems, optimal caching, and Dijkstra's shortest path. We go over the main ideas of these concepts, show some code, which is up on the page. Next week, we will have Greedy Algorithms, third part, and Divide and Conquer. And then there comes the current end of the suspended lectures, just to remind you of that. I have no news about that. I still expect that the lectures will continue to be suspended, and I expect at least for another week or maybe 2 weeks or something like that. So I expect that we will, after that point here, go on with Divide and Conquer and maybe even finish that part of dynamic programming. That's very probable, but we have no news from Urks. So I guess we have to wait for next week and maybe Wednesday, Thursday next week. There will be a statement concerning that, but the official end of the suspended lectures as of now is end of April. Okay. Good. Any questions? Anything? Everything fine? How many are we? 50 now. Okay, 30 of you there. Good. So, yeah, then let me stop sharing the screen over here. And head over to the slides. So, okay, take it on to the slides. Actually, so my slides view, and we are loading. But since I have been always looking at the Book of Klein Dement Tardosch, let me have a quick look to that. Okay, so we are looking. Yeah, that's already there, right? Today we are looking at optimal caching, another example, and we are looking at shortest path in a graph. So I have effectively pushed. Maybe I'll do this in another color. I have pushed the minimum spanning tree problem to the third lecture of Greedy Algorithms. And if there is time, and it's not too cramped, say, I would like to talk about minimum cost arborescences. Maybe I give a very quick overview at least. That's a very interesting problem, generalization of the minimum spanning tree problem, or variant of the minimum spanning tree problem. So that will be Greedy Algorithms 3. And we are looking at optimal caching and shortest path today. And actually, I'm going to start with, go back here, with subset systems. So the first part and the first video was about subset systems. And this is not in Klein-Bakhtarovich. But I wanted to show you the main, a glimpse maybe into the theory of matroids. and subset systems, because that's one of the few pieces of theory we have about greedy algorithms. You can see also in the chapter of Klein-Baktardosh that they have, if you have been reading the book, so in the first two pages they say like, okay, a greedy algorithm is like this kind of local myopic choice, you take an element and take another one and never revise your decision. So once another decision has been taken, it's never revised, you stay there forever. And that's it, basically. And there's very, very little theory. And then they go on and give lots of examples. And the main insights we have from these examples are the concrete algorithms. So you know how to do optimal caching, you know how to do shortest path, for example, and some of the proof strategies, like an exchange argument, you keep switching elements of the solution, or this greedy algorithm stays ahead argument, and you compare the greedy solution to the optimal solution. That's interesting material, but beyond that, there's very little theory. And so subset systems give us a piece of theory. And so here the first slide is just a reminder, right? So a subset system has a universe of elements and has a set of feasible sets, which are, so the feasible sets, so a set, put it over here, a set, just a second, what's the problem here? Oh, the problem is the tool. Okay, any set which is a feasible set is also a subset of the universe. So the elements of the universe compose feasible solutions, and feasible solutions are just subsets. This stuff is closed under inclusion. So if some set is a feasible set, then all subsets are true. And then we can define a very simple and natural optimization problem. We just put weights on the elements of the universe, and then we go over all the feasible sets and try to find the feasible set of maximum total weight. So the total weight is just the sum of the weight of the elements which are in the set. And we have seen examples where we can formulate subset systems. Okay. So also a reminder, we have seen this in the last lecture. So you have a natural greedy algorithm, start with the empty set, and you keep selecting elements from the universe such that greedily the weight of the next element is maximal. Remove it from the universe, and if it's feasible to add it to the current solution, you do it. And at the end, you return just the set you have. That's a natural greedy algorithm. And we have been seeing this too, that's the correspondence here. And now we have the main result of the first part of today's lecture. And that is, maybe let me begin below here, the main result over here. The greedy algorithm above solves the corresponding optimization problem, which we have, of an independent subset system, if and only if it is a matroid. And that's a very strong characterization of this kind of greedy algorithms. Okay. Everything you can formulate as an independent subsystem can be solved by this greedy algorithm optimally for any kind of weights. So the weights here are for any weights. Doesn't matter what weights you put on the elements of the universe. That's implicit here. That's very strong. Okay. Formulate any problem as an independent subsystem. And then if it's a matroid, this algorithm solves it optimally. At the end here, that set is the optimal set, just the maximum total weight. And it works in the other direction too. So if that independent subset system is a matroid, greedy algorithm solves it. And if it solves it for all weights, any possible set of weights, then it must be a matroid. So they come hand in hand. It's the same as saying. It's the same saying the greedy algorithm solves it optimally for any weights. It's the same as saying it's a matroid. Okay, that's the main result. That's the main characterization of this kind of this subset of problems that can be formulated as independent substance systems, and the corresponding greedy algorithm. It's a very, very interesting, very strong result. It's the basis of matroid theory. What does it mean to, so going now to the top, to the first bullet point, so what does it mean to being a matroid? Well, an independent subset system is a matroid if it satisfies the exchange property. And the exchange property is just telling, okay, if you have two feasible sets and one is larger, over here, two feasible sets, one is larger than the other, then you can find some element in the larger, which is not contained already in the smaller one, such that you can add this element to the smaller one and it's still feasible. Okay. That's the exchange property. So you can always extend the smaller set T towards the larger set S by picking an element which is in S but not in T. Does it make sense? I mean, it's rather abstract as a property. So if you have a problem formulated as an independent subset system, you have to go ahead and see if you can prove the exchange property. And if you can show that it satisfies the exchange property, it's a matroid, and then you know the greedy algorithm solves the problem optimally. This is a matroid? Yes. Independent subset system. Oh, let me put this in another color here to make it an independent subset system, which satisfies additionally the exchange property, is a matroid. It's called a matroid. Okay. I'm giving you here a glimpse of matroid theory. It's a huge area of matroid theory, and people, I don't know, in the 70s and 80s, they like to study this. There's lots of results, but that's call it the tip of the iceberg of matroid theory. There's lots of stuff to be seen. I don't know about any lecture which teaches that, but I wanted to show you this main result. At least one, our main result. Matroid theory has other results, but that's already very interesting and very relevant for our context. So the exchange property, in other words, again, you have a set T, right? And you have some set S, just larger, let's draw it larger, okay? Note that it's only the cardinality of S which is larger. That doesn't mean that T is contained in S. So it could be like this. And there must be some element difference S minus T. So over here, there must be some element U right here. Which means I can extend T by U and it's still feasible. So I think. Sorry, my dog is seeing somebody. Just a second. Oh no, it's continuous. So we are, yeah, that's the fun of online lectures. My dog is by my side and I can't, well, she will calm down in a few seconds. So this guy passing around. So, well, let's come back to the, the production team seems mad, yes. yeah, she's sitting there looking at me, recording the lectures, and now she's sitting here and watching. Watching the landscape. what I've been explaining. Okay, yeah, exchange property is just like that. Okay, take the T and you can always extend it by U, so one element more, and it's still feasible, right? I mean, T was feasible, so it's in the feasible set, and S was feasible too. And now this T plus U, let's put it maybe over here, is also feasible. That's not always the case. And if you take for example, we have set, let's see, we had an example of a maximum weight independent set. Okay, do you remember that? Oh, Mateus has the question. Are the subset systems in the metric definitions covered in the climate? No, they aren't. They don't have this. And this part of the lecture is additional stuff. You can find it, I guess, in my lecture. Yeah. I just put that here because I find it so interesting. And there's so little on the greedy part and only lots of examples. So the maximum weight independent set, okay, we have been discussing this, I guess, quickly, but for the sake of example, let's take some graph, okay, maybe this guy here, and you have 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, 2, say, some weights, and you want independent sets, right, subsets such that the vertices are not adjacent. So I could take, say, greedily, right, this guy here of value 4. And then I cannot choose anymore these adjacent vertices. Then I would take maybe greedily this guy, which I should have taken in the first place. And then this one is out. And I still can take this guy. So the blue guys are an independent set. We have an independent set. And the weight is, what is that, 10. Of weight 10, okay, for example. Now the question of the maximum weight independent set is just finding, well, the independent set of maximum weight in the graph. And it's very easy to see that you can, so this is a graph, right, with vertices and a set of edges. You have also weights on the vertices, right? It's very easy to see that if you want to formulate this as a subset system, we just take as the universe, the vertices, we have this example, as the feasible sets, all independent sets. And that's, a subset of an independent set is also an independent set. So if you take only two of these blue guys without the others, I have still an independent set. So it's closed by inclusion. And now we have the natural greedy algorithm, which I have been executing. So I should have executed it like this. First, greedily take the largest element, and then greedily take the second largest element, and then greedily take the third largest element, but that's not feasible, so don't put it into the solution. Then greedily take the fourth largest element, that's not feasible, don't put it in the solution. Greedily take, say, the fifth largest, can't put it. And the sixth largest and put it into the solution, that's what the greedy algorithm would do. So this is the corresponding optimization problem we have and the greedy algorithm. And now you have, maybe you can leave this as an exercise. We have that the greedy algorithm, so GR, solves the maximum weight independent set if and only if it satisfies the exchange property. And the exchange property in this case, it would say that if you have some maximum independent, no, some independent set T, and you have some larger independent set S, there must be an element U and S minus T such that T and U is also feasible. So it's also an independent set. And if you can show this property, you have an algorithm that solves that problem. The greedy algorithm will solve optimally for every kind of weight. So it doesn't matter which weights you put on the vertices, it will solve it always. Do you think that's, it's, what do you think? I mean, that's just a guess. You can sit down and look at it. So it maybe remains as an exercise. But what would you guess? in this case. Maybe by reverse engineering, possibly. Any guesses? Will it satisfy the exchange property? Probably not. Okay. Yeah. Since GR does not solve it optimally in all weights or with all weights. Yeah. Yeah, that would be a way to do it. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's good. That's better than what I had in mind. Yes. So if you can put a set of weights on a graph and show that the greedy algorithm does not find the maximum weight independent set, you have shown that it doesn't solve it always. And so it's not optimal. And then the exchange property cannot be satisfied. That would be a way to do it. Yes. Yes. I had another argument in mind, which I called reverse engineering. If you remember that maximum weight independent set is NP complete. So the probably not holds for that reason too, because if the exchange property would be satisfied, the greedy algorithm would solve that problem. But if you look at the greedy algorithm in this case, what does it do? I mean, it takes vertex by vertex here, takes the maximal vertex, which is still has not been visited, and puts it there, just checks for independence. So selecting this can be done in order of n. If you do it like brute force going over all the vertices, checking for feasibility. You have an independent set. You want to put another vertex into this independent set. You have to just verify that there are no edges to the other vertices. Can be done in order of n2. And the size of the universe is no more than order of m. So the whole algorithm here would run in order n squared. So it's very improbable that the exchange property in this case will be satisfied, just because that would give you a polynomial time algorithm for a NP complete problem down here in the corner. Right? That's very improbable that you can solve that problem and get the $1 million and so on in the term of fame, just like this. Okay. So yeah, probably not. You will find examples where it doesn't work. So you can find an example of two sets, T and S, such that the exchange property does not hold. So T cannot be extended with an additional vertex from S minus T, such that it's an independent set. Or you can just take what Iago has been proposing. You just put on a set of weights and show that the greedy algorithm doesn't solve it optimally. And then you're basically done with that exercise over here. Okay. Okay with that? Make sense? That's the main idea, so the main cool idea about matrix is here. Okay. Anything else? You're good? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it seems there are no questions at the moment. Everything okay? So that's a piece of theory which is out of Klein-McTaggart. So let's get to optimal caching. In optimal caching, so that's the second, no, that's the first example, the first part of our theory. Now we have an example of a greedy algorithm and a, an exchange argument, actually, to show that the greedy algorithm is optimal. So, just to revise the basic parts, we have seen this, hopefully we have seen this in the videos. We have just a universe or main memory of n elements, and you can hold a subset k, which is less than the whole universe in a cache, and then you have a couple of references to the elements in the whole universe. And now if you have a reference to some element di, either you have a cache hit, so it's part of the k elements we have already, and then you can just surf it from the cache, or you have a cache miss. If you have a cache miss, but you want to access this element di, you have to fetch it from the main memory. And that's costly. So the number of fetches is our metric here. We want to fetch as the least number of elements, and to fetch that, and if you have already all the k positions occupied, you have to evict some other element. You have to kick off some other element. You throw out some other element from the cache. It's like this, really. Okay, you have the cache. You want di. It's in the main memory. So down here is u, but it's not in the cache. There are k elements, 1 to 2 k positions. And then you have to kick out some element here. So that's the eviction of some element which is already in cache, and you put the other one in here. Okay. That's what happens. I think that's very, very, very basic and very well learned up, I guess. Okay? Does it make sense? Okay. Good. That's okay. So the first observation we made, that's also looking at that again, is that we can focus our attention on reduced schedules. Okay, reduced schedule is when we say, okay, we could take action at any time. So okay, you are here with your cache. And at some point you want your request element di, and di is sitting in the cache already. So the basic idea here above, so either cache hit or cache miss, it suggests that you just do nothing in this case. You serve it from the cache. But you could actually, at that point in time, also fetch another element from the universe and kick out some element here and just put that element u in the universe. That costs you a fetch, which is not necessary at the current moment, but it could maybe reduce your cost later. That's the doubt here. But actually, we can give an argument, and we have been giving that argument by a lazy evaluation, if you want, that is never the case. So you can postpone these fetches. So instead of fetching it right now, if you don't need to fetch it because di is already in the cache, you don't fetch it. You fetch it only when the access to the element u is really necessary. And if you did something else at that point in time, you push that further down in time. So you just push the fetches down in time, which I call a lazy evaluation, make it at the latest possible point, and then you cannot make more fetches than you did in the standard, in the schedule, which is this kind of prefetching. Okay, that's prefetching is a good by the way, just as a parenthesis here, we're assuming here that the number of fetches is what we want to minimize in this case. And so this kind of reduced schedule is possible because it makes the same number of fetches. You just be lazy, you are lazy, you push it down in time, you do it at the latest possible point in time where you can do the fetch. That cannot cost more. The fetches have been paid. But actually prefetching in current architectures is actually possible, and it makes sense. So we should not confuse this kind of prefetching here in our schedules in this kind of problem with the prefetching in architectures. And this is because when you prefetch from memory, you can overlap the prefetching with computation, right? So if you issue a prefetch instruction on an Intel processor, you just issue the prefetch instruction, say, oh, fetch me this guy from memory. And then you go ahead and make a loop or something else and do computation at that time. And at the end of the loop, you want to access that element, and it's already cached now. So you are overlapping that, and that effectively reduces time. So in this case, you could not be lazy. You could not do the loop first and then issue the prefetch or issue the fetch, because in that case, you have to wait at that moment for the element from the memory to come in into the cache to process. So prefetching actually, if you go down to the level of assembler and do that, that makes sense. That would be a different kind of prefetching. So just to point out, it's just the number of fetches which you are concerned in. Okay? Make sense? Okay. Reduce schedules. I said, okay. Okay, good. No questions here. So let's then look at, let's look ahead. So what we have seen, and this is kind of a greedy algorithm, that's the reason we are discussing it in this chapter, is there is a lady, but it's for the guys from Hungary, probably I should say Balaji or something like that. But this guy, which is working at the United States, if I remember well, in IBM Research, he has shown that the farthest in future schedule is optimal. And that is first, in the first second, you can see this as a greedy algorithm. Okay. Farthest in future is about evictions. Okay, so you evict the farthest in the future. So there are two points to make here, obviously. First, it's a greedy algorithm. You look at all the elements in the cache, and you take the element whose reference farthest in the future, most distant in the future. You take that element and kick it out, because all the other elements will be referred to or will be requested earlier. So it makes sense. And the second obvious comment on that is you can't implement that schedule because you don't know the future in general. So if you know the future, you can implement it. Otherwise, you can't. So this is made for this kind of model here, when you have a sequence of references and you know them beforehand, you know everything before, and then you can plan optimally. Well, that's often the case. I mean, if you know the complete future, you can plan optimally. Otherwise, you have to do something else. So the value of this this idea is not in being a scheme which actually can be implemented. In practice, you have kinds of schemes like least recently used or something like that. The value in the farthest in of the value of the farthest in future schedule is that you can define and quantify optimality. That's the best you can do. And so you can compare, I don't know, FIFO strategies or least recently used strategies or other caching strategies. You can compare them to the farthest in future schedule and see how they do. They will be suboptimal, but the question is, how far are they from optimality? And that's the value of that analysis. Okay. I think the main thing I wanted to remember or to point out here, and see if you have had any questions on that part, is the main claim, first of all. So, I mean, the main claim is here. That schedule is optimal. But how is it done? It's done like this. You have some schedule S, and you take the farthest in future schedule FF. And you assume that they agree on some prefix of actions. If you think about it, okay, the prefix is the prefix in the requests, right? D1, D2, D3, D4, okay. Comes the first request, it's in the cache. They start with the same cache. If the first request comes and it's in the cache, both of the schedules will do the same. They are reduced schedules, so they are just served from the cache. And if D2 is requested later and it's not in the cache, they will both fetch D2 and evict, kick out some element from the cache. And since they agree until prefix J, they kick out the same element. So that happens and continues until DJ. And they agree on that, they have the same initial cache. So after D steps, they have the same cache after these steps because they react in the same way to the requests. And then we assume in that claim that at DJ plus one, they react differently. That can happen only if DJ plus one is not in the cache, otherwise both will search from the cache. And if they choose to evict a different element from the cache, because if they evict the same element from the cache, the state is again the same after J plus one steps. And if they evict a different element from the cache, the state after J plus one steps is now different, the cache state. And we have to see what we can do. And the main idea here is that we can show by a more complicated exchange argument that we can indeed take that schedule S and produce another schedule S prime that agrees on a longer prefix, it agrees now on J plus one steps. And that's not so obvious how to do that. If at step J plus one, the two schedulers kick out another element because the cache state then is different. And you cannot fix that immediately without paying a price. So if you fix that immediately, you change the schedule S, which kicks out some element and not the element that the false and future schedule kicks out, you change it to kick out the same element. Then they agree at the J plus one step and they have the same cache. But then the further steps down in the schedule of S, so J plus two and J plus three and J plus four and J plus five may not be valid anymore. And that's just because we have changed now the schedule at position J plus one. So the further steps down, it's not clear that you can do that anymore. And we have to give an argument how to fix that schedule downstream to make it work. And we have to fix that schedule, that's very important, that argument, such that it does not cost more. You can always fix it such that it costs more, just do anything. But it does not cost more. And that gives in the proof, which is in detail, in the book and the video lecture, we have a more complicated exchange argument. We have to see what happens in the future and then try to synchronize the caches more downstream again. So we are waiting for certain events to happen. There are basically two events which will happen, and we show in both events that we can fix. So we can go on with the J plus twos, J plus third, J plus fourth, J plus fifth element without problems until a certain event happens, which involves the two different elements which have been evicted from the cache. And then at that point in time, we have to fix it and we can show that we can synchronize the caches again. And from that point down into the future, the schedule S works just the same as before. And that's the main argument here. And you can see here a rather longer, a more complicated exchange argument at work at that point, okay? Does that make sense? So just as a high level summary, what's going on here? That's a transformation. It's a different kind of exchange argument. It's also interesting maybe because our exchange arguments were just like sorting. You can swap two elements at any point. But now we do the sorting in a very specific manner, right? We start from the first element, and then for you, I should maybe start over here. We start from the first element, and then we fix the first, fix the second, fix the third, fix the fourth, fix the fifth, and we fix it always to agree with the FF schedule. Okay. So at the end of the day, any schedule S which agrees on a prefix J can be made to agree on a prefix J plus one. And this holds in particular for the optimal schedule S star. So we take the optimal schedule and compare it to the farthest and future schedule. And we see, oh, the prefix, they agree on nothing. So the prefix J is J zero. But then we can use our claim and say, yeah, but I can produce another schedule S star prime, which agrees on J equals one with FF. that would be possible, even if they don't agree on anything. So the original schedule agrees on nothing with ABAP. Then I can apply my claim once and have a new schedule, which agrees on the first step at least, and it does not cost more. So it's still optimal. And then I can take this schedule and produce another one, 2', which agrees on the first two guys, the two steps on FF. And this does not cost more. So it's still optimal. And so on. And you keep applying that until you have S star. So to the M after M requests, where you get a schedule which agrees on M steps with the farthest and future schedule. And M is the number of requests. It goes down here until DM. So it agrees on every request with the farthest and future schedule. So it is the farthest and future schedule. It's the same. And in all these steps, the cost did not increase. So it's still optimal. And that shows that the farthest and future schedule must be optimal. Yeah, does it make sense? Okay, any questions over here? Let's see. No, seems okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, just to sum that up, say on a personal note, well, the take-home message here is one problem specific. If you think about optimal caching, farthest and future is optimal. So if you do some caching at any point in time where the number of fetches count compared to farthest and future and show that it's only a factor of 2 or factor of 3 from optimality, that's useful to know. The second thing is to maybe remember a different kind of exchange argument. Can give it for pairwise swaps, you can give it offers for prefixes that may work in some of the problems. That's interesting as a proof strategy. So if you have another problem, maybe, okay, you can do more complicated exchange arguments by trying to make prefixes. For the rest, I mean, the exchange argument, and that's also the reason I won't repeat it here again. It's more complicated, it's specific to that problem, and there are not many techniques inside that proof, which I can generalize to anything else. So it's just the way it's done for this farthest and future schedule. So there's not so much interesting, cool ideas which I see that can be applied to anything else, except the way the exchange argument is done, not the individual details of the argument. Okay. So that's maybe the main idea. Okay. Okay, any questions on that? Optimal caching. Otherwise I'm going to move to shortest path, second example. Okay. Doesn't seem to be the case. It's always fun, I have to say. It's like, as it should be, everybody has the mic on mute. But that's for me, it's the main difference to a class, because there's always something and there's always people looking and somebody saying something. And in some sense, I miss that a little because, okay, if everybody opens the mic, that will be maybe a major confusion. But there would be like a kind of ambient mumbling from you would be interesting, because if I ask questions, I have to wait in silence here. But anyway. Okay. Shortest path. Shortest path is famous problem, a very fundamental problem, and we will see to some extent. I mean, it's also we will see a specific method for computing shortest path, but the ideas we see here, there are a couple of good ideas here. Which you can apply to other or related problems. So it's more general than in my view than optimal caching, for example. And what we have is just a director graph, like we had this before. Okay, couple of vertices, couple of arcs which connect them, something like that, maybe. And there are distances here, so it's 1, 5, 2, something like that. And you have a source vertex, it's S. And you want to find the shortest path from every from the source vertex here. It's marked as here over there. From the source vertex to everybody else. And you see in this simple example that you can take 4 here, you take 3, take 3 over there. It's the only way to get to these vertices. And then for this vertex here, down here, you have actually 2 ways to get to it. And the shortest one, so over here, that would be 9. So over here, that would be 9. And over here, that would be 4. So you take 4 here, that's the shortest path. And then for this vertex over here, you have 2 ways. Going over here, that gives you 4. Going over here, that gives you 6. So you will end up with 4. And that's the distance here from S to itself is defined as 0. Okay. So that's what you want to do. We're going to store that in an array. So DS is 0. And so this is vertex V. So DV is 4. We want to compute array D, the distances from S to all the other guys. This is called a, I think I have it down here, right? A single source shortest path problem, SSSP. Single source shortest path. And you can also solve the shortest ST path problem by applying that. So it can be reduced to that. Shortest ST path would be just you have besides the origin vertex here, destination vertex, and you want the shortest path from S to T only. But in general, that's not cheaper than computing all the single source shortest path. You could have to go over all that in the worst case, so it doesn't matter. And if you really want only the shortest ST path, you just run Dijkstra's algorithm, and whenever you hit T, when you first explore T, you stop the algorithm. You can stop it earlier. So that would be essentially the same algorithm. There's also APSP, that would be all pairs, shortest path. For that, you have to work a bit harder. And Dijkstra's algorithm does not apply directly. You could run it from every vertex, right? So you could reduce APSP to n times single source shortest path, starting from every vertex, compute a single source shortest path, and then do it. And then you have the whole distance matrix from everybody to everybody else. But that's too costly. That is simple, it's too costly. So for APSP, all pairs shortest path, they are better algorithms. Can do it in a shorter time. Okay. What else? I've said that you have initially. So what we want to find are the true distances from S to every other vertex, and we want to compute an array that has these true distances. So what you want at the end of the algorithm is that what's in the array DS is DV, so the distance to vertex V is exactly the true distance from S to that vertex. That's what you want to get. And initially we don't know that, so we start with DS equals 0. Know that that's the true distance already. And for all the other guys, you set it to infinity, because you don't know the shortest distance yet. It would be the start here. Shortest path is, I said that already, shortest path is extremely useful. Shortest path, I think in a lecture, and over here I have shortest path. Should be plural, but the shortest path algorithm. It's one of the top 3 useful algorithms, the other 2 being maximum flow and matchings, or maximum matchings. Okay. Not only because you can apply them directly to lots of problems. I mean, shortest path is like what your navigation system in the car does, for example. many other things, but also because they can be adapted to a huge variety of different problems with essentially the same ideas that holds for shortest path, maximum flow, and maximum matching. So it's very, very useful standard problems. So if you can reduce your problem to a shortest path problem, maximum flow problem, maximum matching problem, you can find a sub problem at least that you can use one of the three, you're very happy. All of the three can be solved in polynomial time very efficiently for reasonably large instances. Maximum matching is being the hardest of these guys. And so the big three important problems you should know. So that's part of your tool chest always. They're so common and so useful. So that's the utility of shortest path. And I mean the key insight is here in that slide. I've been talking about that in the video too. When we can relax edges, just remember we're starting from initial zero only for S, everybody else is infinity. So that is superestimated. The values are too high. So we say we are gonna relax an edge if the value is indeed too high. So if there is an arc from U to V, so let's put it like this, from U to V, but the distance from U plus the distance here of the arc is less than the distance of V, we found a new shorter path to V, and then we relax it to that. And we do the same, or we can do the same, for vertices. And here we just go over all outgoing neighbors of V and relax all the corresponding arcs. So that's N plus. That's V, that's N plus of V. That's all the outgoing neighbors. And we're gonna relax all these arcs here. Relax this one, and relax this one, and so on and so forth. We relax the final one over there. Okay. That would be a vertex relaxation. That makes sense. I mean, the weights go only down, they never increase. Okay. So if you keep relaxing and you keep relaxing and you keep relaxing, the weights go down and the weights go down and the weights go down and the weights go down. At some point in time, if the weights at least are discrete, so if you have integer distances, for example, they cannot keep going down forever. Because the weights, that's important. Do we have this at some point here? The weights are non-negative. Okay, that's over here. That's important. So if you think about non-negative weights and you assume that they are, so for a second, for sake of the argument, they are positive or non-negative integers, then you start with these guys here, infinity. And infinity is not in practice. You set it to a large number. The sum of all the distances, something like that. And then you keep relaxing. Just keep relaxing vertices, for example, in a random order, and the weights go down all the time. But there are lower bounds for the weights, for the distances, which are the shortest path. You can't go below that. And so if you go down in every iteration and there's a lower bound, you must essentially stop at some point. And that's not so hard to show that this will be the optimal solution. The main problem with that idea is, so that's conceptually it's very simple, and you should remember or should maybe able to make the connection to the algorithm of Gale-Shapley, you know, for stable matchings. We had discussed that algorithm and had said, okay, it wants a stable matching. So what you do is you take any matching at all, and you look for instabilities. And while there's an instability, make it stable, switch. Yeah. If you remember maybe that algorithm, that has the same character. So it says, while there's an instability, switch, make it stable. And we have found out that for the stable matching, that doesn't work. it's called in the literature, the soap opera algorithm. That's converging. It goes around in circles. But here we have the same idea. Just relaxation improves locally. And the main algorithm is relax until you cannot anymore. So relax maximally. And different from Shapley and stable matchings, it works in this case. If you relax until you can't relax anymore, you have the optimal distances. There must be the optimal distances. A simple argument by contradiction. Otherwise, there's a shortest path, and on that shortest path, there will be a first vertex, which has the wrong distance, and then it could be relaxed. So it cannot be maximally relaxed. That would be the argument, basically. Okay. So that works, indeed. It's a very simple algorithm. Just thinking about relaxations. Relax until you cannot relax anymore. That's perfect. The main drawback or the main catch of that algorithm is can take lots of time. Can take a huge time. Can be very inefficient because it depends on the order you relax the vertices. And here comes Dijkstra. Here comes the main insight of Dijkstra. That's a key insight, the key takeaway of Dijkstra's algorithms here. So let's do this in every possible color over here. Key insight. Dijkstra sat down in a cafe with his wife, as folklore has it, one afternoon, and he took just like a napkin and starts scribbling like crazy on that napkin. And his wife knew, okay, I don't have to talk with him in the next hour or so. And after that, he had probably drinking coffee somewhere in the sun, relaxing, had this key insight that you can relax the vertices, but there's a specific order which makes it efficient. You relax the vertices in order of non-increasing current distances. That's optimal. And I should have put here, you relax them only once. Okay, if you take that order, you have to relax every vertex only once. So do exactly n relaxations if you have n vertices. And that's a key insight that reduces it a lot. Does that make sense? That's the main idea to have in mind when you think about Dijkstra. Okay. Can you see that successive relaxations lead to optimality, but there are orders of relaxations which are better and some which are worse? Make sense? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Hopefully, okay. I have one that makes sense. I'll take this as representative. Okay. hopefully. So okay. That's the main message. That's the main idea of types. And that leads to the following for the algorithm, like. You mark all, since it says once, okay. I have to visit every vertex only once. You say, okay, you make all vertices, you mark them as unvisited. You set the initial distances as we did before. And then whilst there's an unvisited or yet unrelaxed, I think in the lecture I put unrelaxed here also, unrelaxed vertex, you're gonna relax it. Select one of minimal distance. That's Dijkstra's greedy. That's Dijkstra's greedy. That makes it a greedy algorithm. That's Dijkstra's greedy criterion, the minimum DV, current DV. I mean, it's possibly, let's put it in parentheses, because the minimum current DV, I mean, the volumes, the distance volumes keep changing. But actually, the vertex which will be selected in this line, that was the main argument of the proof, will have a volume of DV, which is the true distance already. So in some sense, this current is in parentheses because that current volume now is the optimal volume. But for the other vertices which have not been processed yet, there may be more, there may be more, more decreases in distance. They may go down. Okay, you take this guy greedily, the minimal current distance, then you relax it and mark it as visited. That's the high level, the basic high level idea. You do this loop n times. Okay, I have been remarking that before. And so setting initial distances and marking the vertices and so on, it costs all of n. So do it n times. This guy here, select an unvisited vertices, relax and mark it. And the question is now, how fast can you find that unvisited vertex of minimal distance? Okay. That's the main idea or the main problem. And that requires, does not strictly require, but we will have a data structure that finds the next vertex quickly. That's the main problem. You can implement it by, say, brute force, if you want. So how do you find the next unvisited vertex of minimal DV? How would you do that if you have only 20 seconds to implement it? So this line over here, how would you implement it if I give you now 20 seconds to implement it? Counting down, 19, 18. Yeah, okay, Jago says a for loop over all vertices. Yeah, that's what I would do. I mean, I'm in a hurry. I don't know what to do. Select the unvisited vertex of minimal DV. Yeah, just say, okay, for every vertex here, such that not visited, vertex V, and here is code for remembering the guy of minimal distance, right? Have kind of remember the minimum distance and compare it to the distance of the current vertex to the minimum distance. If it's smaller, you store it and so on. That's it. That's what you do. It's simple. And you can do it on order of n. So you loop over all the vertices and look what's the unvisited guy of least distance. And then you relax it and move on. Okay. The relaxation, by the way, has order of outgoing arcs. So over all the iterations we have been making that argument, you get a complexity which is on the order of the sum of all outgoing arcs over all vertices, which is order of m. So that's the aggregated complexity over all loop iterations already for this line here. So what you get then in this case would be, let's put this maybe down here. You have n iterations of the loop and you take an order of n over here. So that gives you an n squared over there plus the m over here from the relaxations. And that would give you an order n squared m outward. Now, because m is less than n squared always, that's the same as saying it's an order of n squared algorithm. But quadratic time algorithm. So if you take that simple idea of relaxation, make a simple for loop, it gets very, very easy. And you have order of n squared. And that's actually what Dijkstra has been proposing, okay, in his first paper, 65, if I remember well. That's what he has done. It's just this idea and a simple for loop going over that. Very simple algorithm when you get n squared. Yeah. So what I wrote here requires, doesn't require, we can do it differently. But if you want to improve the running time, you have to find a data structure that makes that quicker than order of n. Because order of n we have already. And here come in priority queues. A priority queue is an abstract data structure which encapsulates that idea in the first minute. So I have a couple of operations. I can create an empty priority queue. I can push an element, and it has some key k. And the key is used for ordering the elements in some way. We don't say how the priority queue does that. We can delete min, So we can use it like this. Okay, we can delete the minimum element, so of minimum key, smallest key, and return the corresponding element. That would be finding, so the keys in Dijkstra's algorithm are the distances, and the smallest distance is the smallest key, and the elements are the vertices. So we'll get, by delete min, I will get the vertex, which is the element, of the smallest key, which is the smallest distance. And I can also, because we need that, update elements. Oh, actually, that's missing a Q. So update the Q, take the element E, which is already in the Q, and update the key to K. Can increase it or decrease the key. And now if you make the analysis of Dijkstra's algorithm, again, you will see that selecting unvisited vertices are delete min operations. And relaxing all the neighbors evolves each time when we relax an edge, a update operation potential. So what you get is basically, if you implement it in terms of a priority queue, get a complexity of order times n delete mins plus you have to n times insert an element into the queue. That happens if it's not in the queue already, but that happens only once. And you have up to m updates. And now we have abstracted these ideas, right? We have a priority queue, which has certain operations. We have an analysis of Dijkstra's algorithm in terms of these operations. Now can play with them. For our simple loop, we have a delete min in order of n. We have an insert that actually doesn't happen. It could be constant time. And we have updates that doesn't happen also. It's a constant time. And you get the n squared plus m we had before. Now we can play with priority queues and think about if there's a better data structure to implement that. Does that make sense? Okay. There's also a simple argument on the priority queues. So a question, for example, could you find a data structure which implements delete min, insert, and update all in constant time? That would be perfect, right? Then we would have constant time here, and constant time there, and constant time here. And you get an order of n plus m algorithm. It's linear time. That would be essentially the best we can do. Do you think that's possible to do it? Not sure if a Fibonacci heap does it. Yeah, we've mentioned the Fibonacci dual linked list. Okay. Yeah, I've mentioned the Fibonacci heap. Let me push that a bit forward. Dually linked list, maybe. Okay, so our queue would be like, it has a hat element, dually linked list, okay, like this, these guys, and maybe, the last guy, links back to the first, something like that. Yeah, if you push something, so let's, push or insert, I should. I've been calling this push. So if you do this, okay, let's remove these guys here. So what happens here? It's always interesting to check that. Putting something into the list would be constant time. Just push it there. Update. Update is harder. Right? You have to find the element. But actually, if you work a little bit harder, so if you maintain, and that's actually what's done in implementations usually. So if you maintain for every vertex, which is in the list, the pointer where it is, We can even make the update in constant time. That's possible. It's just a pointer off to the list element. But if your list is not ordered, delete min. For delete min, you have to go over the whole list. You have to check this element, this element, this element, this element to see what element has the least distance. So that would be out of n, if the list is unsorted. And then you're at the same point as before with the for loop. If you have a sorted list, however, then the update will cost more. It's not so easy to do it. So that maybe it's just to get a feeling about the design space. Yeah? You're here on an abstract level, you say a priority queue has these kind of operations. What can we do? There's a second, a different argument I wanted to give you here. Note that it can sort n numbers using a priority queue. Take n times insert and enter to n times delete min. So you insert all the guys into the queue, and then after every call of delete min, you get the first call of delete min gives you the smallest element, and the second smallest element, and the third smallest element, and so forth. So n inserts followed by n delete mins gives you a sorted sequence. But we know, at least for comparison sorting, that we take at least time n log n. Okay, and these guys here, this algorithm has time n times insert plus delete min. Okay. So by comparison, since n log n is a lower bound for that, you know that either insert or delete min or both, one of these operations has to cost at least log n. You cannot get away with a constant time for delete min and push or insert at the same time. That's not possible. You will have to pay one of these guys, log n, at least. So the best you can do, if you think about that, would be for that first part, let me take another color, it gets crowded here. For the first part, best you can do is n log n. And then the pressure is completely on the update, because m usually is larger than n if the graph is connected. It's very common. So n log n is already the best you can do. The pressure is completely on the update. The update will decide what you can do. And here comes the Fibonacci heap. The Fibonacci heap is able to make that in constant time. And then for the Fibonacci heap, you get n log n plus m. Okay. That's essentially the best you can do. Yes. Yeah. Does it make sense? So Fibonacci heap is good, but it doesn't have constant time for all three operations. Fibonacci heaps are also they're a bit out of scope here for our lectures. That would take a complete lecture maybe to look at Fibonacci heaps. They are rather complicated and rather inefficient in practice. So what's done in practice is usually binary heaps. They are more efficient, practically, from a practical point of view, not from a theoretical point of view. So binary heap is something like that. You keep the elements in a binary tree. And here is the smallest element is here on the top. And there, downwards, it gets only larger, or the same, if you want. Or like this, and here also, 6, and 6, and I don't know, 7, and 20. And 41 and 7. Okay. That would be a binary heap. And now the height of a binary heap is log 2 of n, actually. It's binary in the number of elements. N would be the number of elements. And it's not difficult to see that you can do a binary heap, and a binary heap can do a push, a delete, min, and an update in log n, all of these guys. And we have a set already, I mean, the push or the insert and the delete min in some they have. So these two guys, they have to have log n anyway. So it's not as efficient here as a Fibonacci heap because the update also will cost log n, but already very good. If you do it like this, you get n log n for the n delete mins and the n pushes or inserts plus m log n. Okay, and that's a kind of linear time times log n. That's a logarithmic factor higher than best possible linear time in this case. Actually not best possible because you have this lower bound by sorting. But I mean, linear time is the absolute floor for graphs because you have to read it in. Okay. So that's very simple. By just manipulating that tree structure. You can have a look at this if you want. That is actually here in chapter 2.5 of Kleinberg-Talusch. You have this a more complex data structure, priority queues. Okay. And here they're discussing binary heaps, how to update them. Just to finish, so let me show you quickly, or is that okay? Any question on that part? Does it make sense? Binary heaps. Okay. So the algorithm and its whole beauty then, say, is like this. You set initially the distances 0, infinity for the rest. Nobody has been visited. You create a queue. You insert here the starting vertex and the known distance 0. And then you move on. And while the queue is not empty, you call delete min, you take out of the queue the vertex of not yet processed vertex, not yet visited vertex of shortest distance. You set it visited, you will never again process the vertex. And at this point, just to repeat that again, we have our guarantee that the distance, what I've been calling dv, the distance of v is the true distance from the source to that vertex v. And then you go over all the, that's an error here, over all the outgoing neighbors, which are not visited yet. The others don't have to be visited again. Now we have two markers here. If the distance of such an unvisited vertex is infinity, it's not yet in the queue. It has not been seen yet. So you set the distance to a finite distance, the distance of v plus the distance of going from v to u, and insert that guy now into the queue for the first time. So here are the inserts actually. And that happens at most n times. We have the inserts overall at most n times. Otherwise, the vertex is in the queue already, but has not been visited yet. And if then it's unrelaxed, so its distance is larger than the distance from V plus V to U, then you're going to relax it over here. And then you have to inform the priority queue that the distance went down. So the distance decreased at that moment, and then you have to do an update. And the total number of updates over all iterations is M. It's the sum of the out degrees of the vertices. And here comes the, here's the other complexity, and just to complete that, so you have here n times delete mins. And all the rest of the algorithm is dominated by these operations. And so that's it basically. And at the end, you have an array of distances. Okay, with that, main idea, relax in order of non-decreasing distances and you're good. Main idea in the implementation, use a priority queue to make that efficient, to find efficiently smallest elements. And that's very common. You can use priority queues all the time. Okay. Any question over here? No, seems all good. Let me then very quickly head over to the other screen. That would be like this guy here. Okay, so see. So we're back at the main page, and there is greedy algorithms. Two, there is a notebook with codes. Actually, it's only code for shortest path, Dijkstra's algorithm. Just to show it's very, very simple to implement it. So let's have a look at that. So what I'm doing is, you have seen that code or parts of the code, which I've copied and pasted from previous lectures here. It's a couple of it's in Julia, it's a couple of packages, and there's a directed graph with a forward and backward edges, coordinates, number of vertices, and a function which creates that guy. And we have an example graph with 300 vertices and a certain cutoff distance. And here's also a function, the same function from the last lecture, which is going to draw that graph. So you can see that's the graph we have. It has the little arcs, it's a directed graph. And it has this geometric graph structure, could be any graph. But now we can implement Dijkstra's algorithm on top of that. So let's have a look. And you should compare it to the breadth first search we had in a couple of lectures ago. It's very, 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 very similar. What I'm doing is, you'll see the main elements. Vertices are unvisited. I'm setting the distances to not infinity, but type max float, so the maximum float possible. Distance of zero is zero. And there's a data structure, which is all good languages. You have that already. You don't have to implement it, which is called priority queue. And the pushes or the inserts are called NQ here. So I'm NQing into the queue the vertex S with its current distance, which is zero. And I'm going over the queue. So while there are still vertices in the queue, I'm calling DQ, which is like delete min, takes out the element of least distance and gives me back the element. That would be S in the first iteration. I make it visited. I push it onto an array at the end of an array just to remember the order of the vertices, which I use for drawing. And then I'm going over the outgoing neighbors. And if they're not visited, I make exactly the same check. You see the code is very, very close to the pseudocode there. So if the distance is type max float, it's infinity. I have never seen that vertex. Then I set its distance and enqueue it, insert it, push it to the queue for the first time. Otherwise, it's not. So I have the vertex has a distance. I have seen it already. It's if it's not visited, it must be in the queue. But if its distance is higher than the current distance of the vertex plus the distance of going from V to W, I relax it and I update. So that's actually the update operation. You assign it just like it would be an array. You assign to the element W its new distance here. So we update that, and that's it. Okay, at the end of the algorithm, I'm returning the distances, which is the most interesting thing. That's the array of distances, which has the single solved shortest path. And I'm returning also that order. Okay. So it's very, very, very simple to implement and very straightforward. Okay. Now we can have a quick look. So it's a similar animation function as the last time. We'll see. Now that takes a few seconds, I guess. To make that all, and we'll see how Dijkstra is exploring the graph. Dijkstra's algorithm is very, very similar to a breadth-first search. Actually, if you have distances on the arcs, which are all one, you have essentially a breadth first search. So a breadth first search, if you want, that's also interesting maybe to remember, a breadth first search solves the shortest path, the shortest path problem, the single solves shortest path problem for unit distances, for distances which are all one. So you need Dijkstra only if the distances are different. So that's it. You have that stuff, and then you can see how starting from some vertex, I guess over here, you explore the graph. So the color gets from distance zero in red successively to the maximum distance in maximum green. Right. You can see it explores the graph radially. Let's start somewhere over here. Take a random vertex to start it. And there are a couple of vertices which remain black. This guy, for example, it's not reachable. Right? I cannot get to that guy. It's isolated. It has only an arc from here to there. So the algorithm never finds it. Never sees it, and at the end of the algorithm, the distance of this guy would be infinite. So that's what happens. You can see the radial, more or less radial procession here. That's rather radial over here because I have a plane. It's in the plane, but if the distances would be different, that would be a little bit distorted. Okay, you can see how they get more distant, more distant, more distant. How the algorithm processes the vertices in the increasing distance until hitting the final. Okay. So, yes, I think, well, it's 12:06. I think we're hitting the end of the lecture. Okay. Does that all make sense? Do you have any questions on that part? So we've got theoretical result in subset systems, matroid. If you have a matroid, the greedy algorithm solves the problem optimally. We have the idea of optimal caching, and we have Dijkstra's algorithm. So, okay, everything okay? Any more questions? Doesn't look like it. The moment. Okay. No questions here at the moment. Okay, good. So let's wrap up. No questions. Everything okay? Yeah. So let's wrap up. I see you next Tuesday then for the third lecture on GUI algorithms, and next Thursday for the first one on divide and conquer algorithms. Hopefully everything went well with the recording. So here on the page, I will soon put up the video, audio, chat, and also annotated slides from this session. Codes are up already, videos are there, quiz is already there. So please remember to fill in the quiz. If you have any questions after the fact, just send an email. If you have any questions to the list of exercises, just do the same. Otherwise, I'll see you on next Tuesday. Okay. So let's stop. How is that? Let's stop. Let's stop recording.